Thank you, Tim. This session is titled The Medical and Ecological Consequences of Fukushima. The first speaker is Stephen Starr from the Clinical Laboratory Science Program at the University of Missouri. And he is speaking about the implications of massive radiation contamination of Japan with radioactive cesium. Stephen.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today. A large number of highly radioactive isotopes released by the destruction of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant grossly contaminated the Japanese mainland. Most of these radionuclides had short half-lives, which meant they would essentially disappear in a matter of days or months. For many of those who were exposed to them, there will be major health consequences. However, there are some radioactive elements that will not rapidly disappear, and it is these long-lived radionuclides that will remain to negatively affect the health of all complex life forms that are exposed to them. Chief among them is cesium-137, which has taken on special significance because it's proven to be the most abundant of the long-lived radionuclides that has remained in the environment following the nuclear disasters at Chernobyl and Fukushima. It has a 30-year radioactive half-life, which is why it persists in the environment. Scientists now believe that it will be 180 to 320 years before the cesium-137 around the destroyed Chernobyl reactor actually disappears from the environment. Cesium is water-soluble and quickly makes its way into soils and waters. It's the same atomic family as potassium, and it mimics it, acting as a macronutrient. It quickly becomes ubiquitous in contaminated ecosystems. It is distributed by the catastrophic accidents at nuclear power plants because large quantities of volatile radioactive cesium build up inside the fuel rods of nuclear reactors. Thus, any accident at a nuclear reactor that causes the fuel rods to rupture, melt, or burn will cause a release of radioactive cesium gas. Long-lived radionuclides, such as cesium-137, are something new to us as a species. They did not exist on Earth in any appreciable quantities during the entire evolution of complex life. Although they are invisible to our senses, they are millions of times more poisonous than most of the common poisons we are familiar with. They cause cancer, leukemia, genetic mutations, birth defects, malformations, and abortions at concentrations almost below human recognition and comprehension. They are lethal at the atomic or molecular level. They emit radiation, invisible forms of matter and energy that we might compare to fire, because radiation burns and destroys human tissue. But unlike the fire of fossil fuels, the nuclear fire that issues forth from radioactive elements cannot be extinguished. It is not a fire that can be scattered or suffocated, because it burns at the atomic level. It comes from the disintegration of single atoms. Thus, radioactivity is a term which indicates how many radioactive atoms are disintegrating in a time period. We measure the intensity of radioactivity by the rate of disintegrations and the energy they produce. One becquerel is equal to one atomic disintegration per second. One curie is defined as that amount of any radioactive material that will decay at a rate of 37 billion disintegrations per second. So one curie equals 37 billion becquerels. Sometimes these man-made radionuclides are compared to naturally occurring radionuclides, such as potassium-40, which is always found in bananas and other fruits. However, this is a false comparison, since naturally occurring radioactive elements are very weakly radioactive. In the charts from the labs that are in green up there, the radioactivity is described as a specific activity. Note that potassium-40 has a specific activity of 71 10 millionths of a curie per gram. Compare that to the 88 curies per gram for cesium-137. It's like comparing a stick of dynamite to an atomic bomb. Highly radioactive fission products such as cesium-137 and strontium-90 emit 10 to 20 million times more radiation per unit volume than does potassium-40. So which one of these would you rather have in your bananas? It is, in fact, the amount of cesium-137 deposited per square kilometer of land that defines the degree to which an area is classified as being too radioactive to work or live. One may get an idea of the extreme toxicity of cesium-137 by considering how little of it is required to make a large area of land uninhabitable. The lands that were grossly contaminated by the destruction of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant are classified by the number of curies of radiation per square kilometer. There were 3,840 square miles of land contaminated with 15 to 40 curies of radiation per square kilometer. These lands are considered strict radiation dose control zones. The 1,100 square mile uninhabitable exclusion zone that surrounds a destroyed Chernobyl reactor has greater than 40 curies of radioactivity per square kilometer. For those more familiar with square miles, that would be 104 curies per square mile. Consider again that 1 gram of cesium-137 has 88 curies of radioactivity. Thus, as little as one-third of a gram of cesium-137 made into microparticles, distributed as a smoke or gas over an area of 1 square kilometer, will make that square kilometer uninhabitable. Less than 2 grams of cesium-137, a piece smaller than an American dime, if made into microparticles and evenly distributed over as a radioactive gas over an area of 1 square mile, will turn that square mile into an uninhabitable radioactive exclusion zone. Central Park in New York City can be made uninhabitable by 2 grams of microparticles of cesium-137. Hard to believe, isn't it? Remember, these nuclear poisons are lethal at the atomic level. There are as many atoms in 1 gram of cesium-137 as there are grains of sand on all the beaches of the world. That's 10 to 21 atoms, 10 to the 21st power. 1,480 trillion of them, which is 10 to the 12th power, are disintegrating every second, releasing invisible nuclear energy. So this works out to about 1.5 million disintegrations per square meter. You can see how this works then. I included an extra slide just to note the immense inventories of cesium-137, 150 million curies that are located in the nearby spent fuel pool at Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant, which is about 40 miles from here by road and less than that as the radioactive cloud flies. Many of the 104 U.S. commercial nuclear reactors and power plants have more than 100 million curies of cesium-137 in their spent fuel pools. This is many times more than the spent pools at Fukushima. So now that we have some idea of the extreme toxicity of cesium-137, let's look at the extent of the contamination of the Japanese mainland. It's now known that the reactors 1, 2, and 3 at Fukushima Daiichi all melted down and melted through the steel reactor vessels within a few days following the earthquake and tsunami of March 11, 2011. This was not made public by either TEPCO or the Japanese government for 2 months. The greatest amounts of highly radioactive gases were released shortly after the meltdowns, and 80% of this gas released by the reactors believed to have traveled away from Japan over the Pacific. However, the remaining 20% was dispersed over the Japanese mainland. On March 11th, the U.S. National Nuclear Security Administration offered the use of its NA-42 aerial measuring system to the Japanese and U.S. governments. The National Atmospheric Release Advisory Center of the Lawrence Livermore Lab stood up to provide atmospheric modeling projections. The next two slides were produced by Lawrence Livermore and were presumably given to the Japanese government. On March 14th, the easterly winds, which had been blowing the highly radioactive gases and aerosols coming from Fukushima out to sea, shifted and pushed the radioactive plume back over the Japanese mainland. You can see the progression. The red indicates the radioactive plume. Note that the images indicate that the plume first went south over Tokyo, and then reversed and went north as the wind changed. All the areas where the radioactive gases passed were contaminated. However, the heaviest contamination occurred where rainfall, where it rained out. And this is accounts for the patchy deposition of the radioactive fallout. 8 months after the disaster, the Japanese Science Ministry released this map. That's the one with the, let's see, it would be on your right, which shows that 11,580 square miles, which is 30,000 square kilometers, which represents 13% of the Japanese mainland, had been contaminated with long-lived radioactive cesium. Note that the official map does not note any cesium-137 contamination in the Tokyo metropolitan area, unlike an unofficial survey done about the same time by Professor Yukio Hayakawa of Gunma University. Given the fact that the Japanese government and TEPCO denied for 2 months that any meltdowns that had occurred at Fukushima, one must look at all official data with a healthy degree of skepticism. 4,500 square miles, or earlier today we heard 7,700 square miles, which is an area larger than the size of Connecticut, was found to have radiation levels that exceeded Japan's previously allowable exposure rate of 1 millisievert per year. Rather than evacuate this area, Japan chose to raise its acceptable radiation exposure rate by 20 times, from 1 millisievert to 20 millisieverts per year. However, approximately 300 square miles adjacent to the destroyed Fukushima reactors were so contaminated they were declared uninhabitable. 159,000 Japanese were evicted from this radioactive exclusion zone, lost their homes, property, and businesses, and most have received only a small compensation to cover the costs of their living as evacuees. Note here that the criteria used for evacuation is the millisievert. It's not a measured quantity of radiation per unit area that I've described, such as the Curie or Becquerel. Rather, the sievert is a calculated quantity. It's calculated to represent the biological effects of ionizing radiation. In other words, the millisievert is a derived number based on the mathematical models which are used to convert the absorbed dose to effective dose. So what is the increased health risk to Japanese based upon their exposure to 20 millisieverts per year? Let's examine the figures constructed on the basis of data published by the National Academy of Sciences. It was provided to me by Ian Gard. The vertical y-axis is calibrated to the number of cancer cases per 100,000 age peers. The horizontal x-axis depicts the age of the population beginning at 0 years and moving towards old age. Examine the allegedly safe dose of 20 millisieverts per year. As a result of this exposure, there will be about 1,000 additional cases of cancer in female infants and 500 cases of cancer in infant boys per 100,000 in their age groups. There will be an additional 100 cases of cancer in 30-year-old males in their age groups. Now, notice that children, especially girls, are at most risk from radiation-induced cancer. In fact, female infant has 7 times greater risk, and a 5-year-old girl has 5 times greater risk of getting a radiation-induced cancer than does a 30-year-old man. I want to note here that there's a great deal of controversy in regards to the accuracy of the methods used to arrive at the millisievert measurement, especially in regard to an accurate determination of the biological effects of an external versus internal exposure to ionizing radiation. That is, the effects of an exposure to a source of ionizing radiation that is external to the body versus an exposure that comes from the ingestion of radionuclides that provide a chronic, long-term internal exposure to living cells, which are adjacent to the radioactive atoms or particles. In the land surrounding Chernobyl and Fukushima, the primary route of internal exposure is through the ingestion of foodstuffs contaminated with cesium-137, which tends to bioaccumulate in plants and animals. What this means is that cesium-137 cannot be excreted faster than it's being ingested. Thus, it accumulates and increases in its concentration in the plant or animal that's routinely ingesting it. Cesium-137 also tends to biomagnify as it moves up the food chain. This means it becomes progressively more concentrated in predator species. We've seen this before with other industrial toxins, such as DDT, which can magnify its concentration millions of times from the bottom to the top of a food chain. Consequently, all of the foodstuffs in a contaminated region tend to contain cesium-137. Those naturally rich in potassium, such as mushrooms and berries, tend to have very high concentrations. Dairy products and meats also tend to have higher concentrations. The International Commission on Radiological Protection, the ICRP, which sets radiation safety standards, recognizes that cesium-137 bioaccumulates in humans. This ICRP figure compares a single ingestion of 1,000 becquerels of cesium-137, a one-time exposure, with a daily ingestion of 10 becquerels. On a single exposure, notice that half the cesium-137 is gone from the body in 110 days. That's considered the biological half-life. Note also that with a routine daily ingestion of 10 becquerels of cesium-137, the total radioactivity within the body continues to rise, until after about 500 days, there are more than 1,400 becquerels of radioactivity measured in the body. Becquerels can be counted in living persons because cesium-137, the decay of cesium-137, emits gamma radiation, which passes through the body and can be measured by a whole body counter. So they have a chair that kids can sit in, or anyone, and they can calculate the amount of becquerels per kilogram of body weight. So in a 70-kilogram adult, based on this, a total body activity of 1,400 becquerels would correspond to 20 becquerels per kilogram of body weight. And a 20-kilogram child would be 70 becquerels per kilogram of body weight. The ICRP document does not specify the average age or weight of those examined in the study. However, the safety standards that have been set by the nuclear industry do not consider this level of chronic exposure to so-called low-dose radiation to be a significant danger to human health. The ICRP states in this document that a whole body activity of 1,400 becquerels is equivalent to an exposure 1/10 of millisievert per year. In other words, the radiation models used by radiation biologists to convert this level of internal absorbed dose to effective dose do not predict serious health risks from such exposures. In fact, they stated it's safe to have 10 times this exposure level. There is, however, strong evidence that the ingestion of these levels of so-called low-dose radiation are, in fact, particularly injurious to children. Research done by Dr. Yuri Banachevsky and his colleagues and students in Belarus during the period 1991 through 1999 correlated whole-body radiation levels of 10 to 30 becquerels per kilogram of whole-body weight with abnormal heart rhythms and levels of 50 becquerels per kilogram of body weight with irreversible damage to the tissues of the heart and other vital organs. One of the key discoveries made by Banachevsky was that cesium-137 bioconcentrates in the endocrine and heart tissues, as well as the pancreas, kidneys, and intestines. This goes completely against one of the primary assumptions used by the ICRP to calculate effective dose as measured by millisieverts, that cesium-137 is uniformly distributed in human tissues. Let me restate that. This current ICRP methodology, the current ICRP methodology, is to assume that the absorbed dose is uniformly distributed in human tissues. This is, in fact, not the case. This table, taken from Banachevsky's chronic cesium-137 incorporation in children's organs, compares the radioactivity measured in 13 organs of 6 infants. Very high specific activity, that is, levels of radioactivity, often 10 times higher than in other organs of tissues, were found in the pancreas, thyroid, adrenal glands, heart, and intestinal walls. Banachevsky summarized his 9 years of research in the study entitled Radioactive Cesium in the Heart. With the help of friends, I just finished editing a new Russian-English translation of this work. It was never previously translated, in large part because shortly after Dr. Banachevsky presented it to the parliament and the president of Belarus, he was summarily arrested and imprisoned. Government agents entered the medical institute which he directed and destroyed his archived slides and samples. After he was released from prison, he was held under house arrest. It was during this time that he actually wrote the study. He did so in an attempt to preserve his research, knowing that he was about to be in prison again for a very long time. Just as Soviet physicians were forbidden to diagnose a radiation-related illness following Chernobyl, the Belarusian government acted to suppress the work of Banachevsky, who had been protesting government efforts to resettle people back into land badly contaminated with cesium-137. In Radioactive Cesium in the Heart, Banachevsky also did a correlation between the amount of cesium-137 in live children and their heart function. He worked with the Bellwright Institute, which conducted more than 100,000 whole body counts in Belarusian children, measuring the amounts of internally ingested cesium-137 in each child. There were so many contaminated children in Belarus that it was difficult to find any with 0 becquerels per kilogram. However, only those with less than 10 becquerels per kilogram of body weight had normal electrocardiograms. 35% of the children with 11 to 37 becquerels per kilogram had normal ECGs. 20% of children with 37 to 74 becquerels per kilogram had normal ECGs, and only 11% of those with 74 to 100 becquerels per kilogram had normal ECGs. This slide, which shows the average results from hundreds of autopsies done during 1997, is also taken from radioactive cesium in the heart. Notice a very high concentration of cesium-137 in the thyroid gland. While we generally worry about radioactive iodine concentrating in the thyroid, Banachevsky's work shows us that cesium-137 is likely to play a major role in thyroid cancer, too. I want to point out again that the currently accepted medical and legal understanding of cesium-137 is that it is, quote, distributed fairly uniformly, unquote, in human tissues. I copied the webpage from the U.S. EPA website in which this quote is taken. Clearly, the autopsy human tissue samples analyzed by Banachevsky show that this is not the case. This new understanding needs to be incorporated into the way we understand how internally ingested radionuclides act upon the human body. 2 million people in Belarus live on land severely contaminated by cesium-137. Most of the children that live there are not considered to be healthy, although they were before the nuclear power plant at Chernobyl exploded. 14 years after the explosion, 45 to 40% of high school graduates had physical disorders, including gastrointestinal anomalies, weakened hearts, and cataracts, and 40% were diagnosed with chronic blood disorders and malfunctioning thyroids. I'm afraid that there are many Japanese people now living on lands equally contaminated with radioactive cesium. If Japanese children are allowed to routinely ingest foodstuffs contaminated with cesium-137, they will likely develop the same health problems that we see now in the children and teenagers of Belarus and Ukraine. Thus, it's very important that we recognize the danger posed to children by the routine ingestion of contaminated food with cesium-137, wherever they might live. It's also important to prevent further nuclear disasters which release these fiendishly toxic poisons into the global ecosystems. Given the immense amounts of long-lived radionuclides which exist at every nuclear power plant, this is an urgent task. I hope I've made it clear that long-lived radionuclides produced by nuclear power plants are neither safe nor clean. What suggests that it's a very bad idea to manufacture these nuclear poisons to try to make electricity, that it's past time we stop manufacturing them and try to manage those which we have already created, which must be isolated from the ecosystems for at least 100,000 years.
Thank you, Stephen. Now we have Dr. Timothy Musseau from the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of South Carolina. He's going to talk about Chernobyl, Fukushima, and other hot places and the biological implications of these.
Thanks, Helen.
I guess we'll bring this up. There we go. Cancel it, yeah.
Right, well, let me start by thanking Helen and Mally and the PSR for organizing and hosting this event. It's really wonderful to be here. It's a fantastic opportunity. And surprisingly, I think, well, maybe not surprisingly, this really is the biggest event of its sort, I think, around the world today. I think this really is the main event, so count yourself lucky to be here.
You need to speak further in the mic.
Oh, sorry. There we go. Sorry about that. I'm used to screaming and yelling to a group of students, so I'm not used to talking into a microphone like this. Anyway, I've been working in Chernobyl with my colleagues for about 13 years now, and this first slide really here is to remind me to acknowledge the many partners, some of the key partners that we've had over the years, especially Anders Møller, who's been my main collaborator and partner since the very beginning. What you may notice from this list of co-authors is that there are no Japanese names on that list, and I did want to make the point that we've had many very important Japanese collaborators, but who would rather not be named in most of this work. Our first publication, we had a long list of our collaborators. The second publication, we were missing three of them. And the latest publication, all but one of our half a dozen colleagues really didn't want to be have their name publicly associated with the work. It was not that they don't want to help us, but they've been very, very helpful, but they were concerned about the long-term impacts. The other thing I wanted to mention, point out on the slide, are our sponsors, of course, and especially the Samuel Freeman Charitable Trust, who have been very supportive of this work over the years. Right, so a number of years ago, prior to 3/11, we started our work, just by chance, into the impacts of radioactive contaminants in Chernobyl, and it really was an interest driven by evolutionary genetics, evolutionary biology, not radioecology, not nuclear medicine, not anti-nuclear activism in any way. And we started our work with birds primarily because they're easy to see, they're easy to catch, they're easy to identify, they're easy to count. And some of them you can even track throughout their lifespan. And because they can't see, smell, or have even heard about the radiation per se. They're not put off by the fence around Chernobyl, so they come in when they do. We can follow them, and we can track their lives in the very most highest contaminated areas. And this gives us a lot more resolution, a lot more power to conduct studies of the long-term health impacts, at least if you're a bird or a bug, of these contaminants. And of course, following 3/11, we've changed the name of our group to the Chernobyl Plus Fukushima Research Initiative. I don't expect you to read this slide. It's actually just a list of the 50 or so publications that we've generated in the last 7 or 8 years, and really all it's to show you is that we've been busy. And because I know my time up here is rather short, I'm going to start backwards in my talk. I'm going to start with the conclusions, and then we'll move backwards through some of the supporting information just for fun. And so the major findings, after working in Chernobyl since 2000 and in Fukushima since July of 2011, and we can say most of this from Chernobyl, though, most organisms that have been looked at in any detail show significantly increased rates of genetic damage in direct proportion to the level of exposure to radioactive contaminants. We have a couple of papers on this topic. I'd be happy to point you to them. We've reviewed the literature, as have others, and it's overwhelming. Most organisms living in these areas show increased rates of deformities and developmental abnormalities. Some of them you might even call tumors and cancers, in direct proportion to the contamination levels that they're living in. And because these are animals and plants and things like that, they don't move too far usually. Most of the organisms that we've looked at show reduced fertility rates. In terms of the male birds, about 40% of the male birds in the more contaminated parts of Chernobyl are completely sterile. They have no sperm. And we've looked. I'm not going to show you how we've looked, but we've looked very hard. And 40% of the males have either no sperm or just a few dead sperm when we take the samples. Most of them that we've been able to measure have reduced lifespans. And as a consequence of the reduced fertilities and reduced lifespans, most of these species, most of these populations, have smaller sizes, reduced growth rates. The numbers of individuals in most of these groups are lower in the more contaminated areas of Chernobyl. And as a consequence of this, many of these species have actually gone locally extinct in the more contaminated areas. So biodiversity has been affected. The last two points are a little more speculative, and they're a little bit more based on indirect evidence. They're hard to test directly, but I think our indirect evidence is pretty strong, especially now that we can compare the findings from Chernobyl to those that we're seeing in Fukushima, and we hope to compare Fukushima and Chernobyl to other naturally hot places around the world. The first is that it's very clear in Chernobyl, ironically, because the radiation levels are so low, because they're low enough that organisms don't drop dead immediately as a result of exposure, they live long enough, some of them live long enough, to accumulate mutations and to pass them on to the next generation. And these will accumulate over multiple generations. This is our hypothesis. I think the data we have is strongly supportive of that. And we're not the first ones to suggest this, of course. There are no original ideas in science. The last point here, which is also equally interesting, I think, is that, again, because this isn't a black hole in its entirety, some of these individuals live long enough to reproduce, to migrate out of the area. The young of the year, some of them will migrate out, carrying the mutations that they've accumulated. So we see the effects of mutations in populations that have never seen radiation per se. And so I think, from my perspective, those as an evolutionary biologist, those are two important points. Most of our work has been done on animal models. And you know, it and in some ways this has been good because it's allowed us to sort of pass through some of the gates and barriers that might be have been erected for people who study human populations. And if you're working on birds and bees, you know, you don't get taken too seriously for the most part. So you can do things that other people can't do. But also, perhaps, birds don't drink or smoke or get depressed, as far as I can tell. Maybe there's a few male birds who get depressed about not finding a girlfriend, but for the most part, we don't have to worry about some of the environmental issues that have been suggested as important for some of the effects that we see in the human populations, alcoholism in particular, and drinking. And, you know, the sorts of questions we ask, again, as we're just biologists, so, you know, we ask, can we measure mutation rates in these natural populations? Does it relate to the radiation levels, contamination levels? Are there any consequences to the mutations? We all carry around lots of mutations inside our bodies. Most of them are never expressed. Most of them have no effect. So, you know, quite conceivably, the levels that we're talking about, maybe they induce extra mutations, but they don't matter because there are no expressed consequences. So we need to test for that. Are there deformities? Are there neurological developmental effects? These kinds of things. Of course, you know, all of us are different in this room. Some of those differences are the result of mutations. Most of them don't matter. It probably doesn't matter too much that I'm missing a little hair here as a result of some mutation. And it's probably not influencing my survival or ability to reproduce. So, you know, a lot of these mutations, even if they're expressed, don't really influence survival or reproduction or adaptation. And so we need to get at that. Doesn't matter. And finally, population sizes and ecosystem consequences. All right, so here's where we're a little different than most people. This is sort of the schematic of the approach that we've taken. It's kind of unique, and I really have to give a lot of credit to my collaborator Anders Mahler for really pushing this. And basically, what we do, so the world is, you know, the natural world is a complicated, heterogeneous place. Even in New York City, you know, every corner is a little bit different with respect to the amount of sunlight, the microtemperature, the amount of rainfall, the sorts of other plants that are there, the other bird species that might be flying in. Every point in space and time is unique. And so how do you factor out that variability to ask simply the simple question of, or not so simple question of, what is the effect of radioactivity or radioactive contaminants on an individual, a population, a species? And the way we've done this, got at this kind of question, is to employ what I call a massively replicated biotic inventory design. It's a long word. Basically, we go to as many places as we can squeeze into a short period of time, and we count every last organism that we see in these different locations. So in the case of Fukushima, we've made 700 of these inventories in the last 2 years. In the case of Chernobyl, we stopped at 896 because it takes a long time to do these things. But we go to a spot and we measure everything. The numbers of birds, the species of birds, the numbers of insects, the numbers of spiders, whatever is possible. And we also measure all of the environmental variables that might be of relevance in terms of determining the presence or absence and abundance of a given group of organisms. So the meteorology, the hydrology, the geology, the community of plants. Is there water around? What kind of plant species are there? That kind of thing. And then we, of course, measure the radiation level too. Right. For the most part, we've used very simple measures of radiation level, and we've learned that actually captures most of the heterogeneity in radiation just by using a simple Geiger counter. That's certainly a good proxy for most of the sorts of things that we're looking at as we've learned in the last year. We throw this into a GIS kind of model, geographic information system kind of model, employ some fancy multivariate statistics, but nothing so fancy that anyone in this room probably could learn to use them, and to generate predictive models of radiation effects on populations. So when we do this, we can get at the partial effects of the radioactive contaminants on natural populations. It's worked pretty well. And so here you can see our areas of Belarus and Ukraine. This actually doesn't show all of the sites, but they're throughout these areas. Inside the exclusion zone, outside the exclusion zone, 896 surveys to date. Here's Japan, Fukushima. This is the general area that we've been to. Tokyo's down here, of course. Koriyama, 300,000 people. Fukushima City, 300,000 people. Here's the area of highest contamination. Here's a closer view of the areas that we've been sampling from. You'll note that we have not managed to get to this area here of highest contamination, despite our best efforts. Last summer, we did manage to get inside, you know, the 20-kilometer zone and to some areas that were on the order of 100 microsieverts per hour. So a good solid range. The trouble actually in Fukushima isn't finding hot spots. The trouble is finding cold spots to compare them to. And we have spent way more time looking for control areas with minimal contamination than we have looking for the hot areas. And I think that's informative. The first way we get this information is to do biotic inventories, where we just basically look and count everything. Another way is to set up nets for the birds. We set up about half a kilometer of nets. Anybody recognize? I'm sure you can recognize this guy, but anybody know this guy? Yeah, Jeremy Wade, River Monsters. They're doing a show on Chernobyl called The Atomic Assassin. But anyway, they were out to see how we count birds. And unfortunately, this video doesn't work, but this is just to show you that we do catch birds. And we get blood samples, we get feather samples, we measure everything that's possible to be measured on a bird in a relatively short period of time. This is actually a lot of fun because we get to handle the birds. We also get sperm from the males, if they have any. And we don't hurt the birds. We do release all the birds. We don't engage in destructive sampling at all. So that's how we catch the birds and get bird data. How do we measure radiation? Well, we do it a number of ways. In the good old days, we just took our Geiger counter. In the last few years, we've gotten a little more sophisticated, and we've taken our radionuclide identifier system into the field, and this will actually give us, you know, not only will it give us the radiation level, but it'll also tell us what's accounting for the radiation in the given areas, which is interesting. So this is a $15,000 Geiger counter, essentially, but very, very useful. We can take the same instrument. Well, another way that we look at radiation dosage these days is we can take little TLDs. These are tiny little crystal chips that capture radiation that we can then return to the lab and read how much external radiation and what the external dose that this bird has actually gotten by taking this TLD, putting it on a bird band, putting it on the bird, releasing the bird, then recapturing the bird. We can get a pretty good idea of how much radiation they're actually getting. The first bird there was actually my pet bird, who was the guinea pig for this system. And you can't see this because it's too dark and it's too bright, both at the same time. This is a barn swallow, again showing one of the TLDs here. Can you see that at all? It's just washed out. Yeah. Anyway, but you could see it here, right? You can see this little package here, which has basically got this. Anyway. And then the last way that we measure radiation actually is to take birds, put them in a special lead cave in the field without hurting them, and measure their whole body burden. And this has just given us a lot of information. You get these little spectra that look like that. And it turns out that we now know that there's actually a very good relationship between our simple Geiger counter measures of background radiation and the place that we catch the bird and how much radiation they're experiencing both externally and internally. And I'm just going to zoom ahead because I do want to get to some real data shortly. All right, so undoubtedly a few of you in this room have heard these stories, right? The Chernobyl zone is this thriving Eden for wildlife. Who hasn't heard that story? You know, you have heard it, yeah. Yeah, it's just, you haven't heard that story? Oh, okay. it drives me crazy because it's been perpetuated by primarily a few journalists and a few unscrupulous sorts, and it probably is the result of this statement generated by the Chernobyl Forum a few years ago, who suggested that the populations of many plants and animals have expanded and the present environmental conditions have been a positive impact on the biota of Chernobyl exclusion zone. And they've also suggested that most of the human morbidity is a result of stress, right? But the truth is, at the time this report was written, there were no studies of biodiversity and abundance in the Chernobyl zone. None. So how could they come to this conclusion in the absence of data? Well, of course, that's the way it's done, right? The absence of data is used to support the notion that there are no effects. Yeah, anyway. So we decided to use that as our call to action, and we went out and started counting all the critters as we did. There's a few critters in the zone. These are my favorite, the Chevalsky's horses, beautiful horses that were introduced into the zone. They were actually extinct in the wild, except for and kept in a few zoo reserves. They were introduced into the Chernobyl zone because they thought this would be a nice place for them to live. Let's get an endangered species and put it in the most radioactive place on the planet. Yeah, okay. But, you know, there's these reports. There was an article published in Slate magazine a few weeks ago. A former employee of mine, in fact, who's taken a few photos. He's been working there since 1986, and he's managed to capture a half a dozen decent photos of wildlife in the area. And so he's published a few of these pictures. And here's some wild boar. Here's some eagle. Here's an elk or something. And there are some critters in the zone. It's absolutely true. But I want you to see this map. Now, you have to be able to see this map, right? So this is an outline of the Chernobyl zone. And I want you to see, here's the power plant. And the darker colors are the hotter areas. And what I want you to note is that there are vast areas of the Chernobyl zone that are absolutely pristine with respect to radioactive contamination, and now there's no people there, too. So it's a very heterogeneous place. And so, as it turns out, that if you go to these clean areas, and in fact, this clean area right here is half the background radiation to Central Park. Central Park out here in New York is about 0.1 microsieverts per hour. This is about 0.05 in the cleanest parts of the Chernobyl zone. So to suggest, anyway, just, yeah, you know, it's just, I think you get the idea. It's just, yes, you will see the occasional animal inside the zone just because it is a nice, clean place. It's a happy place. Anyway, but we decided to test this more directly because it actually doesn't matter if there are more animals inside the zone or not compared to outside. That avoids the main question. The main question is there an impact of the radioactive contaminants on these individuals and populations and species? That's the main question, not whether or not a fence keeps hunting out and allows some species to do better. So anyway, so we started counting them, and here's our first result. And this is the abundance of birds. And I apologize for graphs, I can't help it. We have to use them. The abundance, the total numbers of birds, when you factor out all of these other things that can be that are associated with variation in bird numbers, and just look at the effects of radiation of the contaminants, there's only about a third as many birds as there should be in these radioactive areas, highly radioactive areas. And there's only half as many species because, again, some of the numbers are so low that they're not sustaining populations of a given species. So biodiversity is depressed by about half in these birds. When we first published this paper, some of the folks said, well, you know, birds, they're hypersensitive to everything. You know, the canaries in the coal mine, right? You know, you can't be thinking about just birds. And so we decided, okay, we'll do something else. And actually, so we started counting the insects because actually we had noticed that it was really hard to find some of the insects. And so anecdotally, so we decided to count them. And sure enough, one of the most notable things is an absence of bumblebees in these most contaminated areas. And some of you have heard about the reports out of Japan, mutant butterflies. It's true. Butterflies also appear to be hypersensitive to these contaminants, or hypersensitive. As a group, they seem to be much more sensitive than some of the other insect species. And very, very few butterflies in these most contaminated areas. Very few spiders, and which is actually kind of pleasant because as you're doing work in the field, you don't have to worry about cobwebs hitting your face if you're an outdoorsy person. It's one of the things I hate about doing field work is cobwebs. Don't have to worry about cobwebs in Chernobyl. Many fewer grasshoppers, many fewer dragonflies. But of course, then the response you get is, well, insects. Who cares about insects? They're just bugs. What we care about are mammals, right? Because we're a mammal. And it took us a long time to figure out a way that we could sample the mammals, work with the mammals, because they're not easy to work with. They're smart. They tend to be nocturnal. Many of them are subterranean, at least part of the time. They're just hard to do basic science with. And so then it dawned on us, let's go back in the winter and look at snow prints in the snow. Anybody know what this print is? It's a wolf, yeah. Yeah. So there are a few wolves in the Chernobyl zone, but mostly they're dogs. So we counted all the mammals and found the same basic relationship, many fewer mammals in the more contaminated areas. 2 years ago, we invited a group from Finland to come do some trapping, focusing on the small mammals. There have been a couple of folks in the U.S., for instance, who've been suggesting Musso and Mahler are wrong. We've been studying mammals, small mammals, for 15 years, and we see no effects. There's no mutations, there's no effect on samples, on abundances. So we brought some independent folks who aren't connected with Department of Energy or any of these other organizations to trap the heck out of the mice, and we found the same basic pattern. Many fewer of these small rodents, big impacts on reproduction. So in fact, now when visitors come to the Chernobyl zone, you've heard about all the tourism. The Ukrainian government has been trying to make money by busing in tourists to see the reactor. And of course, many of these tourists come because they've heard that there's a lot of wildlife that they can get pictures of. And of course, they come in and there's nothing to be seen. It's very, very rare to see anything of significance. And so they set up a petting zoo in the town of Chernobyl. This is a BBC reporter trying to get her pictures of the wild animals of Chernobyl. So I think we've managed to convince a few people at least that actually Chernobyl is not this wildlife haven as suggested by the Chernobyl Forum. We've repeated this work in Fukushima, first in July 2011, then in July 2012, and as long as they allow us back into the country, we'll be back there in July 2013. Again, at 400 discrete locations to do our biotic inventories. We've also been working with barn swallows and barn swallow nests. What do we find? Well, with respect to the birds, we're finding the same basic overall pattern with respect to significantly reduced numbers of individuals in the more contaminated areas. It took us a couple of seasons to convince some of our local Japanese colleagues to really listen carefully, but it's a very silent place in most of these highly contaminated areas. Many fewer birds, many fewer insects, and it just smacks you in the face if you're paying attention. But anyway, strong effects. They're actually stronger in Fukushima. There were 14 species of birds where we could do direct comparisons between Chernobyl and Fukushima, and the relationship between radiation and abundance was twice as strong in Fukushima this first year as it is in Chernobyl, implying that perhaps there's a lack of resistance or there's an increased radio sensitivity in this naive population. Perhaps Chernobyl birds have evolved resistance to some degree, or just the ones that are susceptible have been weeded out already over the last 26 years. We don't really know the answer to that, but we're hoping to get to it. I've only got a few more minutes here, but if you, and again, you probably can't see this very well, but maybe you can. Chernobyl. Basically, every group that we've looked at show declines in the higher, more highly contaminated areas. In Fukushima, the first year, we just basically saw, you know, bird abundance and biodiversity. Butterflies were dramatically impacted, negatively impacted, as were cicadas, which aren't found in Chernobyl, so there's no comparison. But the other groups of insects were not negatively affected, as best we could tell, and spiders actually went up in numbers in the more contaminated areas. Anybody have any ideas why spiders might go up? Why would spiders go up? Excellent. Bioecology 101, that's great. There's no birds around. So, you know, the main cause of spider mortality are birds. And so that's our suggestion. The second year, we've just finished the second year analysis, and it turns out that the effects are getting stronger. This is just a plot showing year-to-year change in the slope of the relationship between radiation and abundance, and the slopes are generally more negative in the second year than the first year. We'll see what happens this coming year. I just want to show a couple more slides because I don't want to eat into my colleague's time too much here. But so we know that population effects are significant. Are there developmental abnormalities? And I need to show just a couple slides because there's some pretty pictures, or not so pretty pictures. But we don't see any Godzillas or King Kongs, of course. But what we do see are very strangely anomalous organisms, including, you know, birds with very strange color patterns. So here's a barn swallow here. He's a partial albino. Here's a better view of the sorts of strange color patterns. Again, not enough to kill any bird, but this bird, this is a male bird, and you can bet that this will influence his reproductive success. Girls don't like this. Girl birds don't like this color pattern. Interestingly enough, I just got this photo by email from the Japan Wild Bird Association just the other day. And this is from Minamisoma, which is a little town just north of the reactor on the coast. And I don't know if you can see this. See these little patches of white feathers here? This is where we started first seeing anomalies in Chernobyl. And so I was shocked and surprised. Well, maybe I shouldn't have been, but I was surprised that they would capture these photos and send them to me. So we're starting to see some consequences potentially. We need to go back and verify that this is real. But we see all sorts of strange abnormalities, tumors on the beaks, strange growths on the beaks, strange missing patches of skin. And let me just skip ahead a little bit. Tumors around the eye are really quite common. Here's a tumor over on the side of the head. Patches of white feathers where there shouldn't be white feathers. Strange growths on their feet. Tumors on their wings. Here's a close-up. Strange growths around their rear ends. Just never been seen anywhere else in any great abundance, and they're much more common in areas of high contamination. Their brains are smaller. The neurological development's clearly impacted as a consequence of the contamination in direct proportion. And not only that, if they have smaller brains, they clearly have reduced cognitive function because they're much less likely to survive to the next year with these smaller brains. The trees are deformed. Here's a Christmas tree looking, you know, Pinus sylvestris, which is normally tall and straight, like a loblolly or a longleaf pine with a single trunk. Here are some other images of the deformed trees that you see all over the place. Some of this is the result of mutation. Some of this is the result of ongoing radiotoxicity from the cesium in the environment. Here's a firebug. Somebody mentioned Cornelia Hesse Honegger, the Swiss artist who first started to document these abnormal insects around nuclear power plants in Europe. Here's the firebug, which is one of the bugs she first documented. And And here is a collection of our Chernobyl firebugs. And if you think of these as being sort of African face mask-like things, it's really easy to see the abnormalities. Very, very unusual patterns. Again, highly correlated to background radiation levels. We got a paper coming out in the next few weeks, maybe month, showing that the birds in Chernobyl have much higher rates of cataracts. Again, another trait associated with ionizing radiation. And as I mentioned before, fertility rates are dramatically impacted with many of the birds having no sperm. So I think I could go on and on and on and on and on, and I won't. And let me just finish again with the beginning again. So why has it been so easy? Apparently easy. It's not been easy in the sense I've had to eat a lot of Russian food. But why has it been so easy for us to go in and document one response after the next that they slap you in the face? They're so easy to find. It really hasn't taken a genius to make these observations. They're there. And the answer is, of course, that nobody has looked. Or if they've looked, they haven't followed through to compile the data and to analyze it properly and then to finally, publish it. Why is that? Why haven't they done this? Vladimir, why haven't they done this? Yes, sir. That's what I'm thinking. They don't want to know the answer to these questions. And so how are they avoiding finding the answers? They just don't pay for research in this area. So they don't fund it, yeah. So with that, I think I will step down and pass the podium on. Thank you very much.
I want to pay homage to Tim Rousseau, who with his colleagues is actually endangering his life by going into extremely high radioactive areas, doing pioneering work which is going to change the concept of radiation exposure to humans. And as you know, we physicians always test drugs and other things upon animals before we extrapolate and use them on human beings. What is happening to the animals, the insects and the plants is going to happen to us. Only we take a long time to reproduce. Certainly in Sweden, they've shown that babies in utero at the time of Chernobyl have lower than normal IQs because the developing brain is very sensitive to radiation. That's reproduced in Tim's work. Extremely important work. The next speaker is Ken Bislar, who is a marine scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, and he's going to talk about the Fukushima ocean impacts.
Thank you, Helen, and the organizers for inviting me here. I'm very pleased to be providing maybe a slightly different perspective, certainly a different field of science, and try to answer that question before lunch, what about the ocean? Because when I think of Fukushima, I think of an ocean event. So I'm doing that from a perspective of someone who's started out working here in Woods Hole. It's a beautiful place on Cape Cod. We have about 850 employees, scientists studying the oceans in all aspects. We're independent, we're not-for-profit. That's come up several times. We rely on private and government funding for each of us individually. So we're kind of like the individual entrepreneurs. And I'm going to give you a perspective of going there as a student in 86. Well, actually, I graduated in 86, which, of course, is the year of Chernobyl. I was focused on, I went there because some of the pioneers of studying fallout, cesium, plutonium in the oceans, were in Woods Hole. And I was trying to learn more about the fate of those isotopes from the 60s, where they ended up in the 80s when Chernobyl went off. Because of that accident, I stayed. I was a student they never got rid of, and we immediately started studying the Black Sea and the consequence to that basin from some of the fallout from Chernobyl. So this event happened. I had actually moved out of this field. I was looking at radionuclides in the ocean, but more for climate studies, nutrients. But when we heard about the accidents, when I talked to some of the Japanese scientists, I'll show you some of the data, we immediately knew we had to get there and find out independent confirmation. What are the levels? How bad was it? And this is just a picture of a ship from the University of Hawaii. We were very fortunate to find very quick funding. This is in June of 2011. Typically, I plan cruises 2-3 years ahead of time. So between the time when the Moore Foundation came through with the funding and we were on the docks in Yokohama, it was about 6 weeks. Unbelievable. Great cooperation, by the way, from both American people and the embassies there, the Japanese scientists who wanted this to happen, but maybe weren't, couldn't be as vocal about that. But we were able to get permission, actually somewhat after we had left the docks, but to sample within 30 kilometers and outwards from there. I'll show you some of our data. But so I was very fortunate to be able to pull that together. It was also very international. We had, France, Spain, the UK, American, and many Japanese scientists both on board and that we shared samples with after. So we tried to encourage that intercalibration. I'm a research scientist. I want to see how my data compare to someone else's. And the only way to do that in these situations is to have the same water in hand and do the same analyses. So that was a big part of this. Now, I've spent my career trying to measure what are really small amounts of radioactivity in an ocean, I say a sea of radioactivity. That's not to say, you know, radioactivity is not a problem, but typically when you're an oceanographer, there's many, many more decay events, radionuclides out there that occur naturally. We've heard about potassium-40, we've heard about uranium-238, I guess we haven't yet. But these, if you add up how much is in the ocean, again, we're an ocean planet, most of the volume here is the big numbers are because we're in a big ocean planet, are in units of our petabecquerels that we heard earlier this morning. So these are the million billion becquerels, these decay events. So there's a lot of potassium-40. I have to get out of my sample to measure a little bit of cesium. And we'll get back to the relative levels, but we should also realize then typically the amounts of the cesium from things like global nuclear weapons testing, the largest source to date, might be 400 in the units of petabecquerels. Chernobyl, we heard earlier, 85. Fukushima, we'll talk about. Three Mile Island was really a trivial release of that isotope. So that's something we have to live with. We heard about bananas, and we shouldn't make the comparison, but I think actually I disagree a little bit. You know, if we look at the radioactivity and the response, these are beta emitters that have similar energies, and so we actually can make some comparisons. But the point here on this slide is that there's much smaller amounts of radiation in the ocean that we can measure than are generally considered harmful to us. And that applies to both things like cesium and things like uranium or potassium-40. So we can measure one becquerel or less in my lab. I do that over several days in very expensive Geiger counters. Mine are more like $60,000 to $100,000 encased in lead to remove some of the background radiation where we sit for a very long time looking for trace amounts of these isotopes. And of course, we have to realize that in the ocean, just as our human body, these different radionuclides will have different effects, different toxicity. I'm going to focus really only on the cesium data. I just don't have time. And what do we know about cesium? Well, that first slide, most of it's from those weapons tests in the atmosphere in the 1960s, including some of the islands tests. So the Pacific actually has higher amounts of cesium than other ocean basins because of the Marshall Islands and the tests that we conducted there. It was one of the major Fukushima radionuclides of concern. We've heard enough about that. We've heard about the two isotopes. They would have similar chemical properties, whether it's 134 cesium, a two-year half-life, or 137, the one that's around for decades, 30-year half-life. They'll behave the same. Because of that, it's actually something we call the fingerprint. You know, we can actually detect, if we see a certain amount of cesium in a seawater sample, I can tell you what fraction came directly from that power plant versus something like the testing in the 60s. That's quite important because we have all of these different sources to kind of figure out where they're from. So I actually have a very nice method. It's not unique to me, but everyone in this field, to use the isotope ratio of 134 to 137. They were released by chance in some ways by design of the reactors in equal quantities, radioactivity quantities. That ratio was one. So why is this an ocean event? Well, there's a little mock-up of the Fukushima power plants. This is a cartoon taken from a talk by some Japanese showing the releases to the air. We heard about the atmospheric releases. The clouds and rain are really the main vector for atmospheric deposition over the ocean. And we'll talk about the numbers a little bit later, too. And that was peaking in mid-March, so we had an atmospheric source to the ocean. What you've heard about but may not consider is this direct discharge, and I'll show you data from the ocean suggests it actually might be more important for the ocean, how much leaked out of those buildings during and after the accident itself. Something you haven't heard very much about, but of course, the fallout on land also can make its way into the ocean, so rivers are a small source. Groundwater, we've actually heard alluded to, this probably the least amount of data I've seen is on the groundwater concentrations and what's getting into the ocean. So from my perspective, some of the largest uncertainties. And we've also heard, but I wanted to remind you that, you know, more than 80% of all of those sources ended up in the ocean. So that's a large source of contamination. But there's probably the least amount of sampling. I'm just envious of all these maps that have thousands of data points and people holding Geiger counters. There's very few data from the ocean, so there's still large uncertainties in what I'll be talking about the quantity in the ocean, where it went. But I'll try and summarize as best I can. So some graphs. There's a timeline here on the bottom axis from April 1st to basically 1 year later in 2012. I'm going to be talking exclusively in units and becquerels. This is the amount of cesium per cubic meter. So this is a concentration of cesium in seawater. The little map, I don't think we really need it, but it just shows those red dots from right at the reactor itself, but in the ocean. So these are people going out, taking samples of seawater, bringing them back in. I've had to use this crazy tall and logarithmic scale to get the range of concentrations we're going to talk about here, because the lowest number here is on the bottom left. It's the level prior to March 11th was about 1.5 becquerels per cubic meter. That's how much cesium was in the ocean off Japan. Each red point is a sampling by an individual taken in, actually released by TEPCO. Kind of complicated to find the data, but they were openly released. And if I translate them into the right units and make some corrections, cancel that, right? Each red dot would tell me how much radioactivity was at that point along the coast on a given date. So they start out here around 10,000, the very first measurements that were made. They're peaking up here up to 50 million. That's a very alarmingly high number, and we'll talk a bit about the change over time. At that level of tens of millions of becquerels, that's when you certainly would have some of the effects we just heard on land, reproductive effects, actually mortality. The other thing about this, when I first heard some of these numbers, you know, the highest we'd ever seen in Chernobyl are down here below 1,000. So this was certainly unprecedented. We hadn't seen cesium levels this high. Now, there's some, you know, good news, bad news. I guess I should talk first about why it peaked later than the accident. So we talked about March 11th was the earthquake, about the 15th was some of the increases in the radioactive in the atmosphere that the highest. There were actually leaks in the buildings and in the subterranean parts of that plant, and some of those were actually pouring into the ocean at levels that were very high here at the early days. You heard about people maybe burning their feet, some of the responses. So that's what was getting in the ocean. They plugged that hole, and, you know, you plug a hole, if you're putting something in the ocean, actually the concentrations go down. You get mixing in the ocean, things move off. It's not like when it falls on land and stays put. This very rapid decrease is because of ocean mixing processes. I'll show you how those work. What was kind of surprising to us when we published this first data was this, though, is that it actually never went back down to what it was. And so that implies a continued source. So you don't have a shape like this of a very quick decrease in early April into June, and then this without having some other supply that maintains cesium up here at about 1,000 relative to 1, so 1,000 times higher than it had been. Now, I do want to put this in perspective from health safety. I'm not a health physicist by any stretch, but I do want to point out, and I'll go back to, you know, there are about 12 becquerels of potassium-40 in bananas. There are levels of concern for drinking water in the U.S. It's about 8,000 in those units. So they have a regulatory limit of about 90,000. So they're allowed by law to put up to about 90,000 becquerels per cubic meter of cesium in the ocean by the operating license of TEPCO. Our plants have similar things. They're allowed to have certain levels in the ocean. That's because these are considered safe. And what we'll talk about at the last part of my talk is, well, what does that mean also for, that might be safe for your exposure, but what about the uptake into fish that we might be eating? So I'll end my talk with the seafood side. But first, some data about what happened. That was at the coast, right? Those red dots. How about further away? We saw, you know, what was that, 50 million. Well, these numbers are now going to be more like several hundred, 500 becquerels. The height of this tube, this is some Japanese data, is how much was there. This is April 2011, so very early on. My take on this, the most exciting things to us about what this told us is that some of it got pretty far away. That's about 1,000 kilometers, 600 miles away, pretty quickly. That would be that atmospheric input. So it's there. It was spread throughout large areas of the Pacific Ocean. But then there are these hot spots up close, and our concern was what's going on closer to Japan, because those are the levels that we had most health concern on early on. This is April. We didn't know what was happening. So this is from our cruise in June. And so it's a map showing you the coast of Japan. The star is the location of the Fukushima. That gray kind of blob, people here may not have heard of the Kuroshio. We call it the Gulf Stream of the Pacific. It's a very fast current taking water basically offshore. And that gray just gives you kind of where it was in June when we sampled. Now, we were measuring our exposure on the ship, actually more concerned about hitting debris than the radiation levels because they had come down significantly. But this map was produced after with kind of high accuracy methods, standards and things to get actually what's causing that concentration difference. Why is it? And what, again, strikes me is some of the numbers are going to be less than 3 down here, so very low levels back to those background. And the big hotspot there is over 3,000, it's 5,000 becquerels per cubic meter offshore. The last spot was 500, now we're back up to 5,000. What's going on to cause that pattern? Why is it high and why is it low in other areas? Now, the first thing you kind of can see, and I'll tell you the answer to, is the low numbers are in the south. If you put cesium into the ocean in the north, basically the Kuroshio is going to be the barrier, the wall that keeps the cesium to the north of that. So that actually was important information for people living down here in Guam and other areas, that the cesium contamination would be highest north of the Kuroshio. Now, why is there a bullseye there? Why are there red circles here? Well, after the peak releases, that has to do with coastal currents and oceanography. So we had physical oceanographers on board who study where the currents are going. And they do that sort of like, you know, message in a bottle. They put out a satellite sensor on the surface of the ocean with a drogue so it moves with the currents and see where these go. It's that simple. And so there's a little eddy, a little circular motion here where water that was contaminated very highly would stay near the coast and not move offshore. So we took good advantage of that when we published this data and all of our data available to say we could tell something about the distribution by knowing the currents, and I'll show you some further examples of how that works. So here's more of that data with the squiggles, and just to show you, this gets to back to maybe the debris question too, but it's when you release these floats, so this is actually my floats with the GPS system on them, released at each of those black dots, that's where we were on the ship. How far did they get? The color changes with time. So these colors out here in purple are the most recent readings of where they were, and these are the earlier readings. So you're seeing basically the progress across the Pacific Ocean of something that's following the water itself. Now, debris would actually move faster. Some of the things we heard about, the soccer balls, the things coming up on our coast, are above the water as well as in the water, and so the winds can push them even faster. But certainly the water itself would have crossed about 180 of the dateline here, half of the Pacific Ocean, just over a year after the accident. That's something we know quite well and can actually model and have done a good job with. I'll show you one more example of that. This is a model of the plume and where it would go early days. We had heard about that U.S. naval vessel and trying to be in this area and having to avoid other areas. They knew kind of right away, actually, some of those currents and how fast they'd be moving. This ends on April 30th. So you could actually have made predictions, and we were doing that, where things would end up. I'll just do that one more time. The biggest uncertainty in this not only is the quality of the input to the model, the winds, the currents that you go in there, but also was most of that cesium. This is a model run where all of the cesium they're looking at was released into the coast. This doesn't include the atmospheric release, so it's not a perfect view of things, but actually it's something we were using to guide our sampling. And these authors point out that it really tracks, the reason it looks like that snake moving out there is because of this Kuroshio current. That's what's driving the transport of cesium across the Pacific. So how far and how fast? If you take the broader look of the Pacific Ocean and you look for the front of where you see the edge of the cesium moving, this goes till March 2012, about 180 degrees. This is actually based upon samples, not models, which kind of confirmed what I've been showing you. So this is an interesting slide. We held a symposium in November in Tokyo that was both a private scientific conference for 2 days with Japanese international scientists and a public forum after that. And some of the big questions were, well, what about today? Now, today was November of 2012 when this slide was given to me by Yota Kanda from this Tokyo University of Marine Science and Technology. So they took an area off the coast and drew a box around and said, well, how much cesium is in there at that time? Now, we heard earlier about the petabecquerels. There was a lot of cesium. Well, now we've kind of decreased it because over time, there's less and less cesium in the ocean water off Japan. One of the bigger questions, and I don't have time to show you the data, but the seafloor itself has become contaminated. Now, this is not a big fraction of the many petabecquerels that was released, but it's still there. A small amount of a big number is still a big number. So we have a situation, by sampling those muds, by sampling the seafloor and counting how much cesium is there, we can compare that number to what we had looked in the seawater. And you find actually now there's actually more in the seafloor off of Fukushima than in the water. So if you're looking for effects, if you're looking for where it's ended up, that's where you should be looking. The other reason they did this is they were trying to confirm what I told you earlier, because those red dots aren't going down. Why? There must be a source. So they actually did very careful studies of the rivers, and they found a sediment load as well as what we call dissolve. It's coming down with the water. And so some of the properties of these isotopes vary, and sometimes the sediment itself is the main source. It's also highly episodic, so rain events. If you don't sample right after the big rain, you're not going to capture the flow out. But certainly rivers continue to be a source and will be a source, well, certainly over the half-life of cesium, decades to come. The power plant itself, that's a harder number to get at. Again, we don't have groundwater samples. We don't have access to samples. We have data from their sampling, but not our own samples. But we get into a number that's certainly on the same scale as the rivers in terms of the releases through November. The data, the red dots I started showing you with all of the levels, I just looked yesterday. I found numbers through January. There's still about 1,000 to 10,000, mostly in the 1,000 level. They are coming down, but really slowly. So we still have this continued source that's of concern. With probably some pretty big error bars, but these are true. It's not just my saying the levels are still high. This is a Japanese study with some careful analyses from those areas. Another couple things. How much was released? We've seen a couple of estimates, and I've tried to put here on a graphical scale several different studies, and you don't have to know all the names, but there have been many of us who've been trying to get at the atmospheric release quantities. 10 to 40 is that range of petabecquerels of cesium-137, so just one isotope, how much came out in the atmosphere. There's a bigger range in those blue bars, how much came out into the ocean discharge, something like 3 to 15. I think there's some consensus. We think they're actually coming together, but there's far fewer samples to constrain that blue numbers than there are the other numbers. But you put those together, I think we should do it. We need to compare the total release, say, of Fukushima to other sources. That global fallout, that amount that had come in the 60s had decayed away. This is a number of 290 from 1970. I could have gotten a more recent number, but it's slowly decreasing. The amount in the North Pacific Ocean left from that, because that's a global number, is something like 70. So we're putting in another 15 to 30 petabecquerels over 70. And Chernobyl, as we heard a couple times, is about 80 in those units. But remember, Chernobyl was hundreds of kilometers from either the Baltic Seas to the north, the Black Sea to the south. And so most of that, only 10 or 20% got in the ocean. So again, still for the ocean, this is a larger event. And then just before the fish, you know, what's going on here? And this is kind of my frustration in a way is we don't know many of these arrows very well, right? What this is supposed to be is the bottom of the ocean drawn here. And what came in? Well, there's still big uncertainties on the atmospheric and direct discharges. We do know that cesium is soluble and moves with that current and will mix down. There are a lot of arrows we don't know very well. If you do oceanography, you're always trying to figure out fluxes and where things are accumulating. So we know very little about the seafloor settling. We've actually measured that directly. Several of us are looking at seafloor burial, transport of those sediments. This remineralization is a big unknown. And then the source from the power plant and the rivers itself and groundwater are probably the largest uncertainties. And that's just for cesium. We probably know more about cesium than any other. So this is probably why you came to the talk. What about the fish? What about all that cesium in the ocean? And this is a cartoon. I didn't take to make fun of this, but this is the information page from the Japanese Ministry of Forestry and Fisheries trying to explain in a very simple way what happens to the uptake of radioactive cesium isotopes in an ocean that has stable cesium, potassium, other salts in there. And certainly some of that gets carried in, some of it gets excreted. We talked about concentration factors in one of the previous talks. It's only about a factor of 100. It's not like DDT and other things. The accumulation rate is not high. What's more important, too, is that the biological halftime, how long till it would release the cesium if you took the contaminated fish and put it in a clean aquarium, is something like 50 days. It's very short. Some estimates longer, some shorter. It depends on the fish, the life cycle, how active they are. So that's what we expect. Cesium in, cesium out. Small concentration factors, but they should track what was in the water. So what did they find? Now, this isn't my data. I'm not a fisheries scientist, but sort of like the TEPCO numbers, they've been releasing thousands and thousands of numbers with no interpretation. So we tried to take certain aspects of this and just say, what can we say? And the way I've plotted these is, in this slide, it's all of the bottom-dwelling fish that they sample. It's from these different prefixtures here on the Japanese coast. They're taken to a lab and someone looks at the total cesium concentration. And I've actually, just before this conference, reviewed their methods. I actually believe their methods. We can ask questions about that. I've had to use another logarithmic scale, but in each case I've put the limit that's allowed in seafood, and we can talk some more, but it's now 100 becquerels per kilogram wet weight in fish. So anything above that line would be considered shouldn't be on the market. And that's the reason they're closing the fisheries. And what you immediately see is that off Fukushima, these fisheries are closed, the levels are too high. What I also saw in this, as we'll talk about in the next slide, is they're not really going down. And they're up and down. They can range from 10 or even below the axes here up to several thousand for any given location and time. So regional differences, you might expect that because you saw where the cesium came into the ocean. Species, what type of fish are the most contaminated? And it's really the bottom fish and the freshwater fish that we have to be most concerned about. So up in red on the top of the demersal, the bottom fish, epipelagic and pelagic, those are more your open ocean fish. They're certainly water column derived. Neustan are collected in small nets. And then freshwater here, you see just as many above and below the line. We've published this late last fall. I got a lot of flack at the time that they're going to go down, and so I'm going to show you data now up through the end of last year. But basically the points we were making, and I think they're still valid today, is that the levels are still high in some of the fish types. It's an unpredictable variability. At that time, 18% of all of those fish they reported were above the limit. This is new. No one's seen this, actually, except this audience. I went back to that same data source. They had now actually locked the Excel spreadsheets that I had access to before, so I couldn't sort and plot them. I had to find through other sources the same data back so I could actually do this for you, but it was another plot. Now we're going to go through 2012 till January, so 2013. Those same types of bottom-dwelling fish and what's going on with them, and you can certainly see there aren't really dramatic changes over the story we told last fall about those levels. They're still high. Now, these are levels in a fishery that's officially closed, so these are not being brought to market. They're selectively picking things like whelks and octopus that are not this contaminated to allow back to markets to try and rebuild the fisheries. We had one scientist in November arguing, fishery scientists, that we should keep those fisheries closed. They're actually overfishing those areas anyway. It's also kind of odd to me, striking, as an oceanographer, there's thousands of data points up there, and yet there's only a few hundred in the ocean. So if they ask me why, when's it going to change, we can't answer that basic question. So the last thing I did as a geeky scientist is I wanted to see how fast they are changing to address this concern that, well, they are going down. So just bear with me. I switched axes, so you just have a linear axis, so you can actually see things a little better. But I already know it's going to be very hard to see, but this is the Fukushima bottom fish, those same red dots now, just on a different scale. And you look closely, it gets a little bit more crowded here below the line than before. That's the Japanese limit. Things way up, way down, highly variable. 40% were above that line up until here. It actually is 20% now, so there has been a decrease. That still means fisheries should remain closed. What's really striking to me was this calculation. If you took the simple model, 50-day biological uptake and then release of cesium, what should it look like had there been no continued source? So if the source had stopped April 1st when we had that big pulse, we would have seen cesium decrease like this in fish. It is not happening. They're still high. Whether it's, I'll show you the number, is 50% in 330 days. That's my calculation from that data. It's certainly of concern and the reason why those fisheries are closed. So my final summary of what I hope to get across today, and then I have kind of a promotion of what comes next, but I think we've learned quite quickly that it was an unprecedented event for the oceans. I think there's many reasons we want to study this. There's the human health aspects for the dose. There's the radioecology. We know so little about those fish. Why are some higher than others on the same day, the same types, the same time? And certainly we want to do a better job at modeling and predicting. No one can predict today what's going to happen to those fish levels off Fukushima with any certainty. I do like to make the point that Japan is leading most of the studies in the oceans, but more work is needed than they could do or anyone lab should be doing, and that confirmation we talked earlier about international independent labs, I hope that I'm building some confidence in the data and to the public, and at the same time we increase the science that we know. My big pitch these days is we just can't keep measuring the fish. You can measure fish till the cows come home, but you're not going to understand when are they going to be low enough, when is it going to be safe to be consuming these fish. And certainly, though I will say stepping back from that, it's easier to measure how much cesium is in fish than to do things like we've been hearing about health effects from them. So my hat's off to that. And my pitch is that we're going to try and on May 9th have another public event like we had in Tokyo. So these are short presentations on a panel. It will end up with a hard copy issue of Oceanus from my institution, and so you can look forward to that. You can find out more about it online now. I'll try and make sure that website's available so we don't have to scribble it down. And like many others here, we're trying to kind of extend our mission out now, and so we're trying to establish a center that would have some longer-term vision of looking forward at the consequences of having these natural and human-made sources of these radionuclides in the environment, in this case, the oceans. Thank you.